This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The volcano, it's going to blow.
January 2022. A massive volcano erupted from the seabed in the South Pacific. Unlike land volcanoes, the Hunga Tonga Hunga Pai eruption blasted about 150 million tons of seawater high up into the stratosphere, about 12 miles or 18 kilometers high. Closer to Earth than the troposphere, water vapor lasts about 9 days before being cycled back to land or sea. The Hunga volcano sent water vapor above the weather systems where it could not rain out. This atmospheric water remained there for about a year and a half, acting as a potent greenhouse gas, stronger than carbon dioxide while it lasts. Could this eruption add a burst of warming, pushing the extreme heat we've seen in 2023 and early 2024?
What just happened to our climate?
And what just happened to us? Later, we'll talk with George Sakraklides about climate collapse and necrocapitalism. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
Volcano bursts, hung up Pacific roar.
In 2022, a supervolcano in the South Pacific changed the atmosphere. The next 2 years far exceeded temperature records. Everyone feels the heat. Could that eruption cause a temporary burst of heat? A few voices claim this natural cause brought record warming and not our fossil fuel burning. The unique eruption did raise big questions. Now qualified scientists have the answer. Published July 24, 2024, lead author Mark Schoberl explains. The paper title is Evolution of the Climate Forcing During the 2 Years After the Hunga Tonga Hunga Hapai Eruption. After retiring from NASA in 2009, Dr. Mark Schoberl is chief scientist of the Science and Technology Corporation. With over 200 publications, Mark is one of the experts on the stratosphere. Mark Schoberl, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Volcanoes erupt sometimes. Mount Etna is active as we speak. Why was this Hunga eruption in 2022 so fascinating and important? Maybe first start with what happened.
Well, Tonga sits, the island of Tonga, the nation, sits on a subduction zone between the Australian and the Pacific plate. And your listeners may know that subduction zones are the locus of many massive volcanoes. For example, Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens in the U.S. However, Hunga is a submarine volcano, and erupting magma encountered a bunch of seawater, and it led to this massive explosion. The shockwave traveled around the world and back. Material was thrown 50 kilometers, which is about 31 miles, straight up. No modern volcano has erupted material that high, and Hunga threw a huge amount of water into the stratosphere, about 10% of the total. The stratosphere, that's a global total of stratospheric water, which is a lot. But you have to also remember the stratosphere is very, very dry, so one event can do a lot. The water vapor concentration in the stratosphere, for example, is about 1,000 times lower than it is at the ground. It was a big impact on the stratosphere.
So well above the clouds and the weather, the stratosphere is a pretty strange layer. It's not easy to study. Is it true the stratosphere can get colder even as the world below gets warmer?
Well, first of all, the stratosphere is where the ozone layer resides. It's a layer that protects life on Earth from harmful ultraviolet radiation. So it is strange in that sense. The amount of ozone, if it were at the surface, would kill us all. But in the stratosphere, it really does us a good thing. But the example you gave is the stratosphere is going to get colder as global warming continues. Well, this is an example of what's called cooling to space. So the stratosphere, the molecules in the stratosphere radiate directly to space because there's so little air up there. Whereas on the ground, the molecules interact with each other. So CO2 radiates to another CO2 and back. So the radiation is trapped in the lower atmosphere. But in the stratosphere, the radiation just goes out. So when you increase the amount of CO2, you have more radiators, and the temperature gets colder. Whereas in the when you increase CO2 in the lower atmosphere, you get more trapping and the temperature gets warmer.
Okay, so why is an injection of water vapor into the stratosphere significant for global warming?
Well, water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and we don't normally talk about water vapor much as a greenhouse gas because you really can't add and subtract water vapor. It's controlled by the oceans, et cetera. But it does emit and absorb infrared radiation, and stratospheric water is pretty constant, about 3 to 5 parts per million, against a pretty low number. So a number of years ago, there was a small natural drying event in the stratosphere. The water vapor went down about 10 to 20%, and Susan Solomon, who worked on explaining the ozone hole, and her colleagues showed that this small reduction in stratospheric water vapor would cause some global cooling and mask the slow upward march of global temperatures. Basically, the water vapor in the stratosphere contributed enough downwelling radiation so that when you remove the water vapor, you get an effect. But the opposite is this case. In case of Hunga Tunga, we have all this water being added to the stratosphere, and therefore the concern is that we'll go in the other direction. Instead of slowing global warming, that will increase global warming. And there are a couple papers, or at least one paper in Nature, where by a guy named Jenkins, who said that we would cross over the 1.5 degree threshold sooner because of this Hunga Tunga volcanic eruption.
Did the new atmospheric water vapor stay in the region? Did it stay in the southern hemisphere? What happened to it?
Well, that's a good question. So initially, it shot up at about 20 south, which is the location of the Tonga. And it's, you know, within about the first month and a half, it slowly spread around in mostly the southern hemisphere. It's very isolated into the southern hemisphere for maybe about the first 9 months or so, and then it slowly began to move upward and into the northern hemisphere. Now the water vapor is spread around globally, and the water vapor is starting to come out of the stratosphere. The lifetime of air or an injection, a volcanic ejection in the stratosphere is somewhere between 3 and 5 years. The circulation air goes up into the stratosphere near the tropical tropopause, and then it comes down at higher latitudes, extratropics, and that circulation process is 3 to 5 years. And we know this from lots of cases of even going back to old nuclear bomb tests, but we've tracked the long-lived tracers and stuff and how long they take to get out of the stratosphere. So the water's coming out slowly now, but we think about time constants of 3 to 5 years for the stratospheric water from the Hunga eruption.
And there's some continuing scientific discussion on this, as you say. In May 2024, Martin Jucker and co-authors used chemistry climate models to find, well, the title of the paper is Long-Term Climate Impacts of Large Stratospheric Water Vapor Perturbations. But as we read in their abstract, they, quote, neglect the relatively minor aerosol loading from the eruption. And your new paper has aerosols all over it. Mark, please remind us what aerosols are found in these remote high spaces, and can we leave them out?
So let's go back to volcanics in the past. So the biggest volcano that we had that satellites could really measure was Pinatubo. And we've had some number of smaller ones since then, but that's one of the big ones. And it generated a lot of aerosols. So what happens is the volcano throws a bunch of SO2 into the stratosphere, and the SO2 oxidizes and forms small sulfuric acid droplets, which sort of shroud the Earth. They reflect the sunlight. And for every volcano that we've ever looked at, that's been the primary effect. That is, they block the sunlight and cool the surface. And we saw after Pinatubo that there was definitely a cooling of surface. There's some debate about how much, but maybe a half degree globally. So most of the volcanoes don't put up much water. They just put up this SO2 and then forms aerosols. Hunga Tunga also put up aerosols. It didn't put up as much as is normally seen for a volcano of this magnitude. And we think that maybe some of the aerosols got scrubbed out. But we do know that aerosols are the dominant effect of volcanoes. And I might add that there's been some of these geoengineering ideas associated with adding SO2 to the stratosphere to create an aerosol layer that would block some of the sunlight and reduce the effects of global warming. And, of course, that every time you do geoengineering, you end up with a whole host of other problems. But that idea is based on studies of the Pinatubo aerosol cloud. Martin's paper wasn't necessarily wrong in leaving out aerosols in the sense that the aerosols settle out within the first 2 years or so. So on the long term, the aerosols probably aren't very important, and the water vapor dominates the radiative forcing. But for the first 2 years, the aerosols overwhelm the effect of the water vapor, according to my study and two other papers that are in preprint. They come to the same conclusions.
Well, scientific discussion is natural, especially when a novel volcano blows up before our satellite eyes. But this event took on legendary powers for some people. It was amplified by the Climate Change is All Natural crowd. Climate denial blogs echoed an article by a retired neurobiologist. He said extreme heat in 2023 and 24 was caused by the Hunga eruption, perfectly natural. What does the science say?
Well, my calculations show that the aerosol shroud associated with, even though it was smaller than a volcano that size, overwhelmed the increased IR flux from the water vapor in the stratosphere. That was valid for the first 2 years. So the net effect was cooling, not warming. And so it would be hard to explain the 2023 warm temperatures with a volcano cooling the atmosphere. So I would say that there are people that have a certain belief that the climate can't change or whatever. They just latched onto this without doing any calculations as such. But, you know, we should always be welcome different perspectives, in my opinion. You know, even non-atmospheric scientists can have some good ideas. And the fact that they are confused or they don't understand something means that we haven't done, as scientists, a good job explaining our science, which is why your podcast is really welcome.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. So we're talking about invisible gases, Mark, and particles spread out widely in the upper atmosphere, some measured in parts per billion. How can scientists measure what's going on up in the stratosphere, and how confident are you in your conclusions?
I'm pretty confident in the conclusions. The stratospheric aerosols and trace gases have been measured since the mid-90s. We've had really good atmospheric measurements with high vertical resolution in the stratosphere. So the appearance of the ozone holes spurred a lot of research and investment in stratospheric instruments, looking out at the limb of the atmosphere and making measurements. And we have done a lot, the community, I should say, has done a good job of validating their measurements. So we fly aircraft around that can fly into the stratosphere. We look at the satellite measurements. We use ground-based instruments that are like LIDARs, for example, to measure aerosol amounts and trace gases. And these generally agree with each other. So we have a pretty good feeling that what we're measuring is accurate. The main instrument that I used is a microwave instrument that was launched in 2004. Because it's making measurements in the microwave, it can measure water vapor and ozone quite clearly through the aerosol clouds, that the aerosols don't disrupt the measurements. For the aerosol measurements, we're using other LIM instruments that have been launched on NOAA satellites. And there's another instrument on the space station called SAGE. And they have been making aerosol measurements since about 2014. So we have a really good suite of measurements in place when the Hunga Tunga volcano went up. Now, as for the future, that's another question. A lot of these instruments are being retired.
They're being retired, and so far no satellite replacements are coming up?
Well, yeah, that's a whole other issue. You know, there are proposed missions to replace the ones that's being retired. So in 2006, the main instrument, the microwave instrument called MLS, Microwave Limb Sounder, it's on the Aura satellite, and Aura was part of the EOS group of satellites, and it's going to be deorbited because it's running out of fuel, and they just have enough fuel to bring it down safely into the Pacific Ocean. So at that point, we'll have a big gap in our measurements. We don't have really anything to replace it. There are some smaller instruments still going, but these are also well beyond their lifetime. We may have a deficit stratospheric measurements for a number of years. Even if these other instruments are confirmed, it takes a while to build them and test them and get them in up there. So there's going to be a gap.
Well, that can be serious in science because we need to often have just a continuous series of measurements to know what directions things are going in. And this is climate change we're talking about. It's pretty important.
Yeah, yeah. And then, and the other reason for not having a gap is you can cross-calibrate your measurements, which is pretty important so that you have a continuous record that doesn't have big jumps in it.
Well, that said, the undersea explosion in the South Pacific, it was astounding. Has it still left experts with questions and work to do?
Well, yeah, that's really true. For example, if you look at how the models have simulated the eruption actually pushed a little bit of material into the Northern Hemisphere within the first 2 months, and no model has been able to simulate that. And we don't really know why this eruption at 20 South ended up in a little bit into the Northern Hemisphere, but no model's been able to do that. So we don't really have a good idea what's going on there. And there's also some controversy about the lifetime of water vapor in the stratosphere. We thought we understood that pretty well from our measurements, but it looks like the latest measurements I've seen, the water vapor amount is not coming down as fast as we thought it might. A third thing that is quite interesting is we had a prediction, at least initially, that there might be a larger than normal ozone hole after the eruption. So the idea was that the aerosols associated with the eruption and some of the water vapor would have gotten into the Antarctic and changed the chemistry of the ozone hole a little bit, and there would have been a bigger ozone hole. In fact, that didn't happen. You know, the ozone hole was quite relatively normal. It was a little bit bigger, but it wasn't astounding. So that prediction was wrong, too. So clearly there's some work that needs to be done. And I have to say that natural events like this really test the models, and they help us figure out what we're not doing quite right. You know, we can simulate everything that's going on right now, but you get a big extraordinary event that pushes the models into a new domain. Then you find out whether your parameterizations and the way your understanding of the system works is correct or not. So this is a learning experience for all of us.
This is Radio EcoShock. Alex is speaking with Dr. Mark Shubrel, Chief Scientist at the Science and Technology Corporation, about a volcano and global heating.
And what you said also has applications for geoengineering, which you raised. I know that I've talked to one scientist some years ago who said, well, we could just put some aerosols up over the Arctic and save the Arctic ice, and then we'd still have the albedo from that. But as you've explained, it spreads to the other hemispheres and just generally moves around the world. You can't just keep it in the Arctic.
Yeah, that's a common misunderstanding that it turns out there's only one atmosphere. We don't have the atmosphere over France, and we don't have the atmosphere over Florida. When you want to geoengineer, you're geoengineering the entire planet because everything spreads around. And so that is a concern. I have another concern about geoengineering, which is, it sounds good, but it actually, I think, to some extent, it's being used a little bit of a distraction away from what we really need to do, which is control carbon emissions. And if people are always saying, oh, there's geoengineering, well, we can solve the problem with geoengineering. That's really not, and that, you know, that technology is untested. We don't know what the impacts are going to be, and it may be very, very expensive. People have talked about every SpaceX launch would carry, you know, 20 tons of sulfur into the stratosphere and drop it off and hopefully develop an aerosol shroud. Well, do you think really that's going to happen? I mean, that sounds nice, but I think the real issue is going to be controlling carbon emissions, and that includes methane and CO2. That's the fun of, and even if we control them now, the lifetime of those gases, at least CO2, is so long that we're still going to have some effects. So I'm kind of a skeptic about geoengineering. And if people decide to do it, they better really carefully look at it, both the cost and the secondary impacts that might happen. And it's got to be a global agreement on doing that. You just can't have one country decide to geoengineer the whole planet, right?
Yes. Well, in my nightmare, some billionaire does it just to protect their own country, they think. Anyway, I'd like to move on because your own work and publication goes back a long way, at least to 1976. And I looked into one of your earliest papers, and I thought, you know, I'd like to read that. The title is The Structure of Stationary Planetary Waves in Winter in relation to the polar night jet intensity. Wow. Does that bring back any memories? You could not have known how urgent your studies would become for the future of humanity.
Right. Yeah. So I was, my physics degree, I was working on wave dynamics, fluid mechanics, basically, in the atmosphere. I got interested, and my advisor asked me to work on wave dynamics in the stratosphere. And the stratosphere is really an interesting reason to study because there's no water vapor, as I pointed out earlier, so you don't have these complicating issues of water vapor forcing, heat release, et cetera. Yeah, and then, you know, I was working on that stuff and stratospheric circulation, and it was really interesting. And then the ozone hole came along. And all of a sudden, a lot of us atmospheric dynamists and chemists who were kind of working off on other things got swept up into the ozone hole controversy. And, well, not controversy as much, like trying to explain it, you know, what was going on there. And it would surprise the entire community, just like some of the elements of Hunga Tunga have surprised the community. And so working on the ozone hole, the part I feel I contributed to was understanding why the ozone hole is contained into the region it is. It turns out that the strong polar vortex region provides a barrier to transport. So the chemistry is isolated in the south polar regions, south polar stratosphere, and it can do its thing down there without being disrupted by the rest of the atmosphere. It's a temporary phenomenon. I mean, the vortex only exists during southern hemisphere winter, but it turned out that wasn't important. The chemistry, which I didn't actually think was right, turned out to be the most important part of that, understanding how chlorine could be released on polar stratospheric clouds. That was a pretty interesting area to research.
Mark, you worked on cloud maps a decade or so ago, and for one thing, anybody installing big solar should take a look for best locations. Are those cloud maps still viable today?
So at the time I was looking at that, NRO, which is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, which you can go to, you can Google NRO, and you can find out what the solar power potential is for your location. They were not using cloud maps. Now they are. They include cloud maps in their forecasts. But I got interested in solar power, and I got interested in doing the calculation correctly. So that including cloudiness, which, you know, how important is that, and how much can you expect a reduction in solar power as a result of clouds? I also ended up using that kind of thing for asking the question, how often can satellites see the surface? So, for example, in some areas of the globe, there's so much cloud that the satellites, even if they come over frequently, rarely see the surface. So those are two aspects of the same problem. And, yeah, these cloud maps are still relevant. In fact, they're better than they used to be because we have a lot more data than we did back 10 years ago. And the data I use is from AQUA, NASA's AQUA satellite, and Terra satellites. And nowadays, we have that kind of data coming from the NOAA satellites using the VIRS sensor. And in addition, we have something called ABI, which is on GOES 16 and GOES 18. And those are really wonderful sensors that have been put up. And they get information about every half hour on the cloud map. So there's a lot more information than there was when I started looking at this. But it's very important that you include these in your calculation. There's some places that are really, really cloudy, and you wouldn't want to put solar power arrays up. And there are some places that are really clear. For example, you might expect the deserts of North Africa to be really clear. And the American Southwest is a good place for solar power. But Vermont, maybe not so much, because it's pretty cloudy in Vermont.
The other thing about cloud maps, maybe we can get better at predicting how cloud cover will change as the world warms and systems change. How close are we to knowing how clouds work at a planetary scale?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. I would say that we're getting better and better at it. Clouds are one of the major feedback mechanisms. So if you increase clouds, you would reflect solar radiation, and that would cool the climate. But it depends on what cloud altitude is. For example, you have low clouds like stratus. They're really good at cooling the climate because they're right down low, and they don't add any infrared downward flux. So, for example, if you have a cloud up high, like a cirrus cloud, that can actually warm the climate, because at night we have cooling out into the vastness of outer space, which is really cold. But if there's a cirrus cloud in the way, it's actually radiating at the temperature of the cirrus cloud downward. So it's like having a little oven radiator above you. So clouds and climate are a complex problem. Not only do you have the frequency of clouds, and you also have to worry about the altitude of the clouds. So this is a really complicated problem, and we're getting better at it, but we're still not there yet, in my opinion.
Yes, I had one atmospheric scientist call clouds the last frontier. What are you working on these days, Mark?
What am I working on? Well, I've got an idea for a sensor that could fill that gap I talked about between when Aura's MLS instrument ceases functioning and help fill the gap for stratospheric measurements. I'm working on convection and improving water vapor in the upper troposphere, which is turns out is a hard problem. And I'm working on a couple other things, including the role of fires. We've been seeing increasing amounts of fires in high latitude regions, so Canada, Siberia, and Montana, et cetera. The smoke from those fires actually gets into the stratosphere, and it has a similar effect to volcanoes. It produces an aerosols in the stratosphere, which can actually block the sunlight. And also it changes the amount of clouds in the upper troposphere. So that's another area I'm sort of interested in because of this increasing trend in fires and higher latitudes. And that's a direct result of global warming, is this warming of the higher latitude regions. That's predicted, by the way. All the warming models predict that you're going to get warmer at higher latitudes. That dries out the forests. They ignite. They get smoke. Smoke gets into the stratosphere, and it causes all kinds of interesting things to happen. So that's another area I'm really interested in working on.
Well, I'll be interested, too, to see how much that smoke cooling is offset over time by the extra carbon that's being released from all those tree trunks and just everything burning. That's a big burst of new carbon up into the atmosphere, too. And the forests, due to climate change, don't seem to be regrowing and recapturing at the same rate.
Yeah, you're actually right. And in addition to the carbon, the smoke in the atmosphere and the CO2 release, there's also quite a bit of methane is released by forest fires. So you have, kind of a double whammy there. That's a really active area of research, and a lot of people are working on that problem right now. I don't know what we can do about it other than point out the issue. You know, we're well on our way to a warming world, and it's stand by and stand back. You know, it's going to be really interesting in the future.
We've been speaking with Dr. Mark Schoberl. He's the lead author of a new paper finding that the Hunga eruption in the South Pacific in 2022 did not cause the extreme heat in the last 2 years. And you can find links to this open access paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Oh, I couldn't be happier. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Coming up, from Greece, George Zakrakladis, Life in Necrocapitalism.
Breaks the wall, smog and fire, beast unleashed, ravenous sky won't be appeased. Ash rain, deadly veil, flying over a whispered tale, ceaseless low burning stream, world in chaos, no more dreams. Future flickers in the haze, lost in burning ocean's maze, rage of earth consuming all, we stand frail.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The necropolis is closed because the heat, don't you see? Too hot for humans, hard as it can be. But the necropolis is open and receiving visitors who never leave. The birthplace becomes the death place. As storms and tides wash over land, the sweet spot is the attraction to the end, the end, the end.
In the birthplace of Western civilization, Greek scientist and author George Sakraklidis sees it ending. Author of In the Grip of Necrocapitalism, we spoke with George in January. His new book coming out this fall is Beyond the Petri Dish, Human Consciousness in the Time of Collapse, Apathy, and Algorithms. From Greece, George Sakraklidis, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's always great to be on your show, Alex. Thanks for having me back.
Okay, now we need to develop this idea of a developing dystopia. But first, how was your summer in Greece?
It's been a very long summer, and not in a good way. It was really the first time that in my life that I was wishing for the summer to be over. It's been really hot, and we've had quite prolonged heat waves.
Twitter had some dire news about it, like over 100 tons of dead fish collected in the port of Velos in central Greece following a mass die-off attributed to extreme climate fluctuations, and no rain for 2 years. Northern Greece faces significant water crisis. Roads suffered through the hottest average summer temperature ever recorded in Europe. With the Acropolis closing and tourists dying in the heat, George, it must be tough to see millions of people flying in for a holiday during an obvious climate crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show how humanity sort of is oblivious. It just does exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to do. I saw cruise ships come one after another here in my hometown, as they do everywhere in Greece. And you can actually visibly see the exhaust coming off of them. I've also been following the food, what I call the food apocalypse. I have lots of updates on that occasionally because there's been crop failure after crop failure. And this summer, it's not just olive oil. It's everything from, you know, malformed kiwi fruit and very strange diseases infecting peaches, which they don't even know what it is, to, you know, grapes being desiccated and not the fruit not being able to fill up with water. Just the kind of stuff that, you know, you would find in, you know, the apocalypse book.
Now, after your scientific training, you worked in the belly of the beast for a while as an expert in consumer marketing. When does the consumer become the product?
Ooh, that's a deep question. We are all products at this point. We have had to productize ourselves. We've had to sell ourselves so that we can be hired. We have to even lie about ourselves so that other people can love us. You know, everything is taking place on an online space. And if you don't market yourself, if you don't create your avatar, if you don't manage to exist within a system that now, you know, functions almost exclusively through technology platforms, then you might as well not exist.
And then, of course, AI just harvests all that and sells it off to other corporations to target their ads at you. So you're really creating your own self as a product, I think.
Absolutely. And it's not just about AI and surveillance and all that sort of very kind of sounds like conspiracy theory to some people and sounds like science fiction that's in the future and that it hasn't really fully happened yet. It's actually happened to on more fundamental levels as well, you know, from the things that we eat to what we do in our spare time. Everything is a mass destruction. We've been living in what I call the necrocapitalist theme park. It's basically a a colorful theme park full of, you know, rides and candy and all these things. And of course, we're meant to consume all of these things, and we're meant to look away from any ugliness, look away from any shenanigans or genocides that are happening in the darkness underneath those rides, where maybe an immigrant is working to restore function. You know, the back office of this theme park is really quite sinister and quite ugly.
But the media does not show us this reality. The devolution will not be televised, as they say. From your new book, The Petri Dish, talk to us about The Great Silence.
So The Great Silence is how I started writing this book. The Great Silence is basically the counterintuitive phenomenon that we see of climate crisis impacts, like we saw this summer in the last year and a half or so, becoming more severe, more stark, more visible, more impossible to ignore. Yet the media is falling into more silence about them. It's just absolutely terrifying. I didn't expect it. I think a lot of people in the environmental movement did not expect this. And this is why I wrote this book, to try to understand this counterintuitive phenomenon. And I've arrived at quite a few hypotheses about why it's happening. Obviously, the media, which you mentioned, does not work for society, and does not work for even for humans anymore. The media is just a vehicle, an executive function of global capital. And anything that threatens the profits of global capital, whether it is a genocide in Gaza or an environmental catastrophe, is silenced. It's really purely for economic and profit reasons. We don't want to disturb the peace. The toxic positivity, which I also talk about in my book, which is something that's been handed down to us from corporate culture, where you have to continuously smile to your clients, is something that exists in our media. And I think the movie Don't Look Up talked about that very effectively, in terms of, we don't want any negative news, not even if a meteor is crashing into the earth. We're not going to talk about that. Or we will actually talk about it, but we'll talk about it in a very jovial way, right? So this is the dystopia that we live in. The media right now is actually our biggest problem. It's not denial. It's not even humans. It's really this dystopian media ecosystem.
Cyberspace is rich in stimulants, but also depressants and anesthetics, really. In the swarm of all those words and hyperimages and games, it's really hard to maintain an independent consciousness. George, can the inner voice and personal senses survive expert algorithms designed to capture and train our brains?
I think it is possible. As much as we are brainwashed, as much as we are being used by the system and manipulated so easily, it is still possible. If you find ways to unplug from it, and by that I don't mean living off the grid, I mean being able to see outside of the system. And this is basically a reference to the title of the book, which is Beyond the Petri Dish. The Petri Dish is basically a metaphor for our civilization. We are as blind and ignorant as a fungus growing on a Petri dish, not knowing that it's going to run out of food. That's basically our civilization. It progresses blindly into the future, full speed, having absolutely no idea, no free will, and you could say no true awareness of the calamity it faces. Yet it is possible to actually rise beyond the Petri dish. And I call that in my book the infinity state. It's a mind state that you can enter if you're able to literally see civilization as a Petri dish. That's a wonderful thing to experience, but it's also very terrifying, because the people who have had that experience realize the dystopia, the matrix, if you'd like, that they are living in. And it's quite terrifying to see that, you know, in your immediate family and your colleagues and your friends, and you just basically see most people as sheep almost.
In your new book, The Petri Dish, you describe a kind of primary drive within us. You call it the RELD, a resource exploitation logistical device. The RELD sounds sort of like an evolutionary computer program in all of us, or is it a psychological mechanism? What is it?
It's our hardware. It's the RELD, the resource exploitation logistical device, is a name that I've given for our brain functions, which are the most, you could say, archetypal, the most primeval brain functions, which are those of survival. And these are highly capable functions. If you think about the fact that looking for food is the most important thing for an organism, survival, then all of these skills that we have today, such as being good at our job and being competitive and being able to look for stuff in a supermarket, all those are adaptations to those primeval skills of the RELD, which are all about exploitation of our surroundings and, unfortunately, destruction and exhaustion of resources. My argument is that all of these sort of aspects which we use in our everyday life, these skills which we think are wonderfully intelligent and human, there is a very sinister side to them in the fact that they are actually really, really dangerous adaptations that went through rigorous evolutionary selection. And the reason I make that argument is because it explains how when we are asked to override these urges to you know, to exploit nature, to manipulate, to destroy, we're unable to. Therefore, it must be something, I don't want to use the word genetic, but it has to do with our hardware. And we have a very, very strong drive to really exploit, basically.
How could profit become intelligent?
Well, I kind of like to have it both ways, actually. I argue mostly that profit is semi-intelligent, but we're at a phase, which I think I addressed in my previous book, Necrocapitalism, that profit has become semi-sentient in the sense that the technology has advanced so much now with for everything from search engines to micro-targeting on social media to all kinds of, you know, AI manipulation of our psychology. There's, you know, already AI programs that almost know us better than ourselves and are able to target us. All of this is coming together. All the dots of all these technological capabilities are being joined. And the prime objective is, again, profit. Profit is colliding with technology. Capitalism is colliding with technology. And it is really a perfect storm, because you've got the brains of technology and of AI with a very simple mission, which is profit. And humans are not part of this equation. So humans have been reduced from the creators, let's say, of our technological world to the simple executors within this technological matrix, which now is driven purely by the numbers. Our civilization, essentially, is now driven not by humans, but by profit. It doesn't have a pulse, actually. It's not human.
And you suggest we should not trust the government. Why not?
Yeah, I'm a little bit anti-government because the arguments I make in my book, actually, is that governments are existential threats. And we can see that today by the inaction on the climate crisis. They're more willing, they're more prepared to lie to us so that we don't panic, than tell us the truth or allow the truth to be told so that sincere and proper action is taken, not just on the climate crisis, but on the poly crisis that we have. I actually, you know, putting my biology experience, my biology hat on, I argue in my book about governments behaving as life forms, they also have the prime objective of survival. So although they may rise to existence, to power as protectors of society, in the end, governments actually end up protecting themselves from society. They become sentient, they become independent, and that's when they really have to go, because that's when they don't care about anything and about any humans. They only care about those few chairs up there in the top. You know, we're at a point in our history when we need changes, we need climate action, we need all kinds of, you know, we need degrowth. And the last authority or institution that could affect that is government. Governments, by definition, are resistant to change. They don't want to change things because that would mean a threat to their own survival.
Now, America's election games are coming right up. It's like a planetary game show with everything at stake. What is the algorithmocracy? And are we seeing the end of human politics, possibly?
I don't know if it's human politics or politics in general. I mean, we've been living in an illusion of a democracy for quite a few decades. You see that the left has the same sort of arguments as the right. Even Green parties, if you check out Green Party agendas, they're also advocating the same things, really. It's just a different positioning. Essentially, all parties, all major parties in Western democracies, which is mostly the countries that I follow, argue for economic growth, which is something that is unsustainable. You know, whether you have the right or the conservatives arguing for, you know, big oil growth in that way, or you have the Greens arguing for green growth through energy transition, doesn't make a difference. Again, we're talking about capitalism, and again, we're talking about really harmful type of economic activity, perhaps less harmful in the case of Green New Deals and that sort of thing. But no one is really arguing for degrowth, which is really what this planet needs. And in that sense, we do have the death of politics, because when voters don't really have a choice, when all choices are the same, then what's the point of voting? You just have different flavors of pretty much the same agenda. And it's another hangover from the corporatocracy, you know, where you have you walk into a supermarket in the States, I know, and there's like, there's like 10 aisles, and three of those are just the cereal aisles, and there's like thousands and thousands of them, but you don't really have a choice that's sugar-free, last time I checked. And so you don't really have a choice, a meaningful choice. And this has been carried over into our politics and is handled by media that, again, is subject to that algorithmocracy of, you know, social media and campaigns now taking place on TikTok rather than on serious debates. We have the merging of politics, news, and entertainment. This is another hangover from consumer marketing. You have consumer marketing approaches that were confined to products now being used in politics. You know, the way that political campaigns appear online and on TikTok is not even intelligent. There's no, you know, everything's about, you know, what Kamala was wearing, or, you know, what color, how orange or, you know, Donald Trump was on a specific day. You know, this is the level of debate. This is the sort of 5-second culture that we have now. Our attention span is extremely limited. And this is, again, a hangover from the corporatocracy, because the less time consumers have to make up their minds, the more likely it is that they will make an impulse decision, whether it is to buy a soft drink or to vote.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is George Sakraklidis, author of the new book, Beyond the Petri Dish, Human Consciousness in the Time of Collapse, Apathy, and Algorithms. Now we get to one of your fundamental insights. In the place of the green narrative of renewables to power this brave new world, you say the climate crisis is not about technology and neither are the solutions. What is the climate crisis then?
Technology by itself has never really saved us. And this is why I'm particularly critical of this green transition. A, because the green transition is not really a transition. We're only transitioning current energy consumption. Energy consumption is going up, and the green transition is unable to cover that extra energy used. So no one is talking about reducing our energy use, which is really what we should be doing concurrently with an energy transition. Again, because they don't want to rock the boat in terms of growth. They still want to talk about economic growth and prosperity and, you know, increase in population. The second reason why technology is really not by itself a solution is that technology is blind. It just helps us overcome problems, but it always, and we know that from our history, it always brings its own problems. So it's in many ways, it replaces old problems that were familiar with new problems that are unfamiliar. So, you know, in many ways, it makes things worse. And this is why also I'm against geoengineering. You know, why can't we plant more trees or use natural solutions?
Why do you say it is the body who eventually triggers the mind to act? I mean, I'm connecting that to the people who are sweating it out and burying their loved ones from heat and finding food shortages and living through great storms. And we always say, as environmentalists, well, finally the public will wake up and we'll get some real climate action. But that doesn't happen. So how is the body going to trigger something in this mind action?
It will. I mean, people will go hungry, and they're already going hungry. And there's a lot of uprisings globally, and a lot of people losing their homes. And although they might not know that they are rising up against the climate crisis, this is essentially what they're doing. The body is really, again, going to our sort of primeval needs. When everybody goes hungry, they will get angry. They will blame someone. They're probably going to blame the wrong people. They're probably not even going to think about the climate crisis. But what that does mean is that it will be an opportunity for a revolution, which is a word I don't like to use. It's a very romantic word, and it just makes things sound fantastic. But I would say there's going to be uprisings, and there's going to be wars, and there's going to be a lot of people that lose their lives, lose their loved ones, lose everything. And there's a critical point. Food, as I was saying before, in the food apocalypse that's taking place, food will eventually become unaffordable, and then it will become unattainable. So just think about that. Think about the impact of that. This is why I believe the body will eventually dictate things, because the mind is completely disabled at the moment. The mind has sunk into this dystopia, and we are way too, you know, brainwashed and zombified into our consumatronic urges and distracted by Netflix and, you know, what Kamala was wearing and all of those things to actually use our mind.
Your book doesn't leave us completely in the swamp of disasters. You have suggestions. You mentioned one of them. Is there any way to introduce us to the infinity state?
Yeah, there is. I think ecological education, although it's arguably too late, if everyone had an ecological education, then, you know, these are the sort of things that humans have done over thousands of years to try and overcome the RELD, to overcome their, you know, genetic urges. You know, they've instituted, you know, educational foundations, and, you know, and even government has had some positive effects, and what we call morality, which is not genetic. You know, morality is something that our society produced. So we need more morality and more ecology. And I think that's a way to access, you know, what I call the vastness, which is, you know, what's outside of the petri dish, and reaching our infinity state. Yeah, I mean, other people suggest microdosing with psychedelics. I welcome that as well, but we have a cultural barrier there. I don't think that will ever happen. Yeah, I do think it's possible.
Well, I know the Japanese have a program where they take tours of people out into the forest and then they just sit by the trees quietly. And that's part of your tour. Now, when you say we do not have a purpose, in philosophy, I studied that. It's called existential nihilism. Personally, I prefer Jean-Paul Sartre's conclusion, we have no purpose and so must create our own. Your thoughts?
Big question. I believe that the question is redundant. I think that it's not whether we have purpose or not. I think it's redundant to be even looking for purpose. I think simply existing is a purpose. But try saying that to your average human, and that's just not enough for them to simply exist within this ecosystem and to be able to share their experience with all the 10 million other species on this planet. For humans, that just has never been enough. This is the problem. We want to be, you know, on top of the food chain, on top of the ecosystem. We want to be constantly proving things to ourselves, and we want to have some kind of a purpose, which is just an obsession, really. Personally, I don't preoccupy myself with that very much. I do feel that I have a purpose as an author and as an activist, but I don't actually sort of sit down at the end of the day and think of, gosh, have I done anything worthy today? I think I used to think like that because the system that we live in tries to make us feel that we're not enough, so that we have to go out and buy the clothes and the cologne and all the, you know, consumer products that will supposedly make us feel better, but they only give us the next 5 seconds of a dopamine hit. The reason I wrote that essay is because I don't think we should even have a purpose. We are wonderful the way that we are.
As we run out of time here, George, why is your Twitter handle called 99 Black Balloons?
Oh, I did that years ago. I had that song in my mind. And I don't know, maybe this explains why I do have quite a big German following. It takes after that famous German pop song, 99 Black Balloons. So, yeah, I guess it's the black balloons are a sign of protest.
From Greece, we've been speaking with scientist, author, and recovering human George Sakraklidis. His latest book, which I read cover to cover, is Beyond the Petri Dish, Human Consciousness in the Time of Collapse, Apathy, and Algorithms. Get George's latest from Sakraklidis.com, and you can find that link and extended notes on the book in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. George, thank you for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Sold out to the big bidders, big players, everything on sale. How much is that child's future, please? Did you travel far?